Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Today, we have a summary of The Diary of a CEO. In this episode, Emma Green, co-founder of billion-dollar brands like Good American and Skims, discusses the challenges of work-life balance and the sacrifices required for success. Her journey from a challenging upbringing to becoming a leading apparel CEO reveals the grit and determination needed to thrive in a competitive industry. Remember to follow us on X and Instagram and on our website podsummarizer.xyz. And now, let's begin.
Work-life balance is your problem. It isn't the employer's responsibility. Look, I have four kids and I had to figure out how I would think about my own ambition balanced with my parenting. That's the truth. And we have to have a level of honesty about what it takes to be really successful.
But is it possible to be number one but still have all of my evenings and weekends?
No, you're not. No, no. If it's possible, tell me who she is and I'll show you a liar.
Emma Green has rewritten the fashion business rulebook.
As the co-founder of multi-billion dollar brands like Good American and Skims with the Kardashians,
she's now revealing the secrets behind her unstoppable success.
You know this Emma here?
Where'd you get these photos?
How old are you here?
15.
And how do you feel about her?
I feel like this person was like dying to escape her circumstances. I was raised by a single mom, one of four girls, and I had a very big hand in raising them to help my mom keep our family afloat. But I thank God every day for the type of upbringing that I had, because it was hammered into me that nothing is going to come easy. And that made me who I am, gritty. Fast forward, and I'm an apparel CEO, someone who goes out and raises hundreds of millions of dollars, somebody who starts an agency in multiple countries. I have zero qualifications to do any of that. Like, I didn't have talent as a designer, but I will just make it happen.
There's a lot of things I want to go into there. What are the three most important things in being successful in business? Do you think it's possible for someone to make themselves gritty? How do we not give so many?
My speciality.
And then pitch Chloe. What was that journey like?
I'll tell you the truth.
This has always blown my mind a little bit. 53% of you that listen to this show regularly haven't yet subscribed to the show. So could I ask you for a favor before we start? If you like the show and you like what we do here and you want to support us, the free, simple way that you can do just that is by hitting the subscribe button. And my commitment to you is if you do that, then I'll do everything in my power, me and my team, to make sure that this show is better for you every single week. We'll listen to your feedback, we'll find the guests that you want me to speak to, and we'll continue to do what we do. Thank you so much. What do I need to understand about your earliest context in order to understand the woman, the very, very unique woman, the very successful woman that is sat in front of me today? And when I ask that question, I'm looking for the characteristics that were most formative in creating the woman that is Emma.
What a great way to start. I think that that's a great question for me, because so much of who I am and how I feel about who I am comes from where I'm from. And, you know, I say it all the time, I'm from East London. I like to make that distinction because I feel like such a Londoner. And I feel like that, you know, being from East London, coming from that place is so much a part of my character. It's so much a part of what is important to me, like that idea of being, you know, someone that is reliable, someone that is honest, not just, you know, sometimes, but all the time. And I'm one of four girls. I was raised by a single mom. And it was so much kind of hammered into me that this is where you're from. This is not where you need to stay. The world is your oyster. You can do anything. You're just going to have to work really, really hard. And I think all around me, I saw a lot of people that were working hard. I saw a lot of people that were hustling and doing what they needed to do just to get through the day. But I had this feeling very much inside of me that if I wanted more for myself, it was all completely within reach. And I think that really came from this, like, East London mentality and all the people that were around me.
I didn't need to do my research to realize that you are a big sister. Because you've got some serious big sister energy. Even with me, we've known each other for a little while now.
Yeah.
So you're the oldest of four sisters.
I am indeed.
How did that shape you?
I think in a really big way. You know, I have a pretty interesting relationship with my mum. You know, my dad left when we were much younger. And our family dynamic is like, she's the dad, I'm the mom and we have three kids together. And I really, you know, I think if you asked any of my sisters, they'd say Emma had this very big hand in raising us, in being pretty formative in our childhood. You know, I would get up as a kid, I'd iron three school shirts, I'd make three packed lunches. My mum would, you know, go off to work. I'd get all the kids in school and half the time turn back around and come home to watch This Morning. that was my life, you know. There was the odd day I decided to stay there, but more often than not, I was just, you know, about trying to help my mum keep our family afloat. And I think that that made me super responsible at an early age, but it also gave me a very early indication of like how I didn't want to live my life. I knew that the milkman hadn't been paid. I knew that there were bills dropping on the, you know, on the doormat kind of every day. And I felt that at a very young age, and I felt the heaviness of that. And I knew it was all down to my mum to make ends meet and to figure that out so that we could all be okay. And I kind of decided at a very, very young age that I didn't want any of that anxiety, and I didn't want that heaviness to stay around and to weigh on me as I grew up.
I feel like children aren't supposed to grow up with the heaviness of bills on the doormat.
Whether they are or they aren't, I thank God every day for the type of upbringing that I had, because I think, it's made me who I am. And I guess there were parts of my childhood that essentially like just didn't exist because I didn't have the ability to, like, you know, and still to this day, it's so interesting actually, like the idea of like just playing isn't part of like who I am. But it gave me a lot of other things. It gave me a sense of, you know, I'm an extremely maternal person, and it gave me this kind of like empathetic route that is like, I'm here to look after a lot of other people. And I know I do that very, very well. My energy had to be about, you know, making sure my sisters were fed and making sure that the house was clean and making sure we were safe. Because as wonderful as East London was, it was also a place where you needed to have your wits about you. You needed to make sure that you'd bought your bike in. You needed to make sure that you were safe. And so my primary instinct wasn't like, let me have a laugh right now and let me see what my friends are doing. My primary instinct was, how do I ensure everybody's safe and the door's locked and we're going to be good?
And at that young age, before the age of, let's say before the age of 16, if I'd met you as a 15-year-old and said, what do you want to be when you're older? What would you have said to me?
Fashion designer. Straight away, yeah. Fashion designer.
And why would you have said that?
I was obsessed. Well, you've got to remember, you know, I was born in 82. And in the early 90s in England, it was like the glory days of fashion. You know, you had all of those supermodels, the Kates and the Naomis and, you know, amazing designers, McQueen and Galliano, and the British kind of Brit art scene and the, you know, British music scene. It was just an amazing time in England. But to me, fashion was this means of escape. It was this fantasy industry. I didn't know anyone that worked in fashion, which is so crazy. My grandma worked in a bra factory, which I laugh about all the time now, thinking about how many bras I make. But that was like as close as anything I knew, like anyone that had worked in like the apparel business. I certainly didn't understand the idea of entrepreneurialism, having your own business. To me, it was just a fantasy. Like, I'm here in Plasto, it's shit. How do I get away from it? And, you know, it's almost like the movies. It could have just as well been Hollywood. It was like, that's over there. It's beautiful. It's glamorous. Wouldn't that be fantastic to be part of that somehow?
And I was thinking the other day about money. I was speaking to a friend and we were discussing money as if it was a person, and playing through the attachment style we would have with that person, you know, like the secure attachment, the anxious, the avoidant. At a young age, what was money as a person in the room, in your life, growing up, in the family?
Like the best, best friend, like the best thing ever. I mean, you know, we worshipped money. We worshipped money, we worshipped what money could bring. We worshipped the material stuff that you could get for having the money. It was all about the car and the bag and the thing and the thing, that was it.
Was money around a lot?
There was none of it around. Okay. Absolutely none. I mean, I knew people that had money, but they were kind of over there doing their thing. They were not part of my thing. But it was so obvious to me when I was a kid that money was something that I needed to find. So in my head, that was always like playing out in my mind of like, how do I get away from that being my reality? And you know, I wanted to leave where I was. You know, I used to have this like vision, and I would draw this fireplace and this beautiful Christmas tree and this credenza. And I would, you know, and I'd imagine like that's the house of my dreams. And it's so, you're going to think I'm insane. But years later, the first, so I had Gray on December 20th and got him back home, sat down with my baby in my living room for the first time and literally burst into tears. And my husband was like, oh my God, isn't it like amazing? We've got this baby. And I was like, no, it's amazing. I drew this scene. This is the scene that I drew my whole childhood.
Having reflected on the profound impact of childhood dreams and the realization of those visions, the conversation now shifts towards the importance of maintaining perspective in business, exploring strategies to step back and assess the broader landscape.
And I think what I've taught myself, like this muscle that I've taught myself, is every kind of quarter, at least every 6 months, I try to float up and see like what is happening, not what I'm telling myself, not what are we doing, like what's happening? What's happening with the competition? What's happening in the market? And back then, I just didn't have the ability to do that. I was so heads down, so in the work, so, you know, like just deep in like my clients and doing the best job that I could, that I had no ability to zoom out. And I do, again, I'm not just blaming myself, but it really was about that inability to see clearly. And so I think for anybody that's kind of been through a moment like that, it's either surrounding yourself with people that are able to help you have a little bit more perspective, or trying to make that a habit that you do that in your business. You know, Bill Gates talks about having reading week, or like, you know, an away week. He takes himself off and he does it twice a year, and he goes and he just like sits somewhere beautiful. It looked like it was like by the water or something. He goes into a little cabin and he just reads. But he thinks about like what is happening in his business, what is happening in the world. And I certainly would never want the comparison to Bill Gates, but I think just having the ability to zoom out a little bit is something that all founders should really, really think about. And it's given me unbelievable perspective that I've made that a practice now.
That's so, so true. I was talking the other day, I think it was actually when I did that solo episode on the Diary of a CEO, about this idea of like clouds and trenches.
I love the solo episode.
Oh, did you listen to it? Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I love them. I think they're so good.
You. One of the ideas that emerged from that process was, as I was writing the solo episode, I thought about the day that I went fishing. Like, I don't fish, obviously, you know, like, you know, but I went fishing because whatever, I just found myself there. And I'm on this boat in the middle of the lake. And the art of fishing is you sit there and you fucking nothing.
You do nothing.
And you're on a lake and it's like pissing it down. So I'm sat there in my Mac and it's just like leathering on me. And this boat, this is not glamorous. This is a 2 meter wooden boat.
Oh, babe, we all had an idea of like a yacht.
No. It was like at a castle somewhere. And it was the most important like 7 hours of my life at that exact moment, because I'd been in the trenches for so many weeks in a row that sitting out on that boat for 7 hours just waiting for this nibble that never came because I'm shit at fishing, it turns out, was so powerful. I thought, like, this is the distinction between being able to stand back from the photo so you can see the picture. And founders, like, especially when you've got cash flow issues and clients giving you shit and team member issues, you're like this.
Yeah.
And I think that the problem is, as founders, we can feel guilt. And
yes,
we kind of talked about this earlier.
Tremendous guilt.
Of like not being in there and not being in the trenches, but because we don't realize we're serving our company by creating a little bit of space.
Yeah.
So is it a practice for you?
It is. And honestly, I've really made it a practice. And
what does
I say
it look like?
That it's about like, first of all, I have to get out of the office. That's the most important thing.
Yeah.
And it's really about me creating the conditions for me to be really thoughtful. So it's like I prepare to like be with myself. Like, so I'm really taking a snapshot of like what's happening with my competition. What are people doing? I'm on the sites of my competition. Like, I'm like, what is the customer seeing? I go like in store. I really try to understand like what is everybody else, like what are customers truly experiencing from this brand? And then it's really about looking objectively at what we're putting out there. And I really do that. And I have a really, really good sense of not, I don't know how to say it without swearing.
Like, you can swear.
I just don't believe my own bullshit. I've still got the ability, and it's so interesting because I think that when you join a new company, you know, I always say to people that come, you know, you've got fresh eyes for, I don't know, a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months at best, until you start telling yourself the same stories that we tell ourselves internally. And I am very good at having those fresh eyes. And so when I have new people in the business, I will go to those people and be like, what are you seeing? Where were you before? What have you, like, versus what we're telling you, like, what are you seeing in this company? And so I make a point to, like, get around to any new starters. And that's just, like, part of the process. Competition, new starters, having the Zoom out. What am I actually, like, serving and delivering to customers? And I kind of take all of that and come up with, like, just a one-pager. Like, for me, it's always very simplistic. You know, it's like three things. I'm like, this. Go and work on those things. And it will often be in line with the priorities that I have, like the broader priorities of the business. But sometimes it's just like a random thing that I'm like, oh, didn't see that happening. I didn't see how shit we'd become at that, you know? And so it's like I try to have that level of objectiveness all the time.
Are you paranoid?
Definitely. 100%. Yes. Well, also, I'm rightly paranoid. Like, I've worked with some of the most, like, copied, duped brands in the whole world. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I'm not actually paranoid. I'm just like, everybody's copying me.
And how do you think about people copying you? Because anyone that's successful, all of my friends that have done anything well, they're just, everyone just copies the blueprint.
I'm totally unbothered it. We've moved already, babe. I'm like, by the time they've copied me, I'm a year and a half in the future. I'm like, go for it. Done. It's over.
You got your first, your first foray into the world of fashion was that internship you had at 19 years old. You became a show producer after that at Inca Productions. You worked at a marketing agency between sort of 23, 25 years old called Saturday Group, which is now known as Wednesday Agency, co-founded by your now husband, Jens.
Yes, indeed.
Which is where you met him.
Yes. Now I'm in business with Jens. So we started our relationship as I was an employee and then he was my investor. So he and his business partner invested alongside somebody else that I brought in my first company. Then I married him. Then we had four kids together. And it has been an unbelievable relationship and one of the kind of most important things in my life and still remains one of the most important things in my life. But it hasn't always been easy because he is obviously, you know, doing his thing and he's very ambitious and he has his own things going on. And when you bring kids into the equation, everything changes again, right? That it shifts a little bit. I think what is important is to have somebody who just sees all of your talent and sometimes sees it before you do yourself. And I think that Jens has been like unbelievably encouraging of me at every turn. Every time I've had any doubt, every time I've been like, God, that feels like a little bit outside of my comfort zone. And he's been like, but you did this, but you did that, you know? And I'm like, oh yeah, I did, didn't I? And he's like,
no, everybody has that. And you'll know people, right? Mm-hmm. Who are really ambitious themselves and maybe their partner is envious, resentful, maybe low-key, subtly plays them down or diminishes their ability to them. What would you say to someone who right now is listening to this and has a partner who they feel doesn't want them to climb to the top of the mountain and isn't willing to help carry them up there and actually sees their work as a competition? What would you say to that person? Because I know we probably got a couple million listening.
I say this all the time. Everything starts with yourself. And you have to be willing to put what it is that you care about, what it is that you want more than anything first. You have to be able to do that first. And if you have somebody who isn't necessarily like a big cheerleader, which not everybody can be for everyone else, that's one thing. But if you've got someone that sucks your energy and your ability to believe in yourself, that's a problem, right? So I don't think that everybody needs the like cheerleader husband, but you need somebody that at least supports your belief in yourself so that you can go off and do what you need to do. But I don't know that there's any big secret. The secret is just being interested in each other. The secret is just growing together. And I think that we are so fortunate that we've been able to work with one another. But it comes from like this place of like interest and respect. And I'm interested in the person that he was. Is this 16 or 17 years ago? I wish I knew. But I'm interested in the person that he's becoming. And I think he's interested in the person I'm becoming.
Quick one. I want to talk about something we all need to take seriously, which is cybersecurity. Whether you're a first-time founder facing your very first audit or a seasoned professional who's been through it all, staying compliant is getting more critical than ever and more complicated, I have to say. And that is where Vanta comes in, who is a sponsor of this podcast. Vanta takes the pain out of security compliance, automating the tedious but essential process of proving your business is secure across over 35 frameworks like SOC 2, ISO 27001. Centralize your workflows, answer security questions up to 5 times faster, and protect your business without losing focus on growth. And this is really a critical part of this. A new IDC white paper found that companies using Vanta save over $535,000 a year, and it pays for itself in just 3 months. For a limited time, my community gets $1,000 off Vanta at vanta.com/Steven. That's vanta.com/Steven for $1,000 off. So 25 years old, you start ITB worldwide, and you run that
25
business.
25 or was I 24 maybe? Yep, something like that.
For a decade,
roughly? Yeah, a decade.
A decade of your life up until 35-ish. And you meet Chris?
Yes.
Jenna?
Yeah.
In this process of these 10 years. When did you meet Chris Jenna?
I met her for the first time, like, on a job that I'd done for one of the girls. I was actually, and I'm sure they must be pretty furious now, actually. I was actually introduced through an agent at WME. They just gave me her number directly, so I just called her.
Why would they be furious now? Because
well, you know, probably. You know, maybe they should have ushered that introduction slightly more.
Having navigated the intricacies of a decade-long journey and the pivotal introductions along the way, the conversation now shifts to the impact of COVID on business strategies and the innovative ways to connect with customers.
And when the tide turned, which it inevitably did, and that really happened, you know, COVID kind of gave you an acceleration, but then the fall off was pretty quick. We had this buffer of an incredible business that allowed us to stay the course.
So if one is, you know, 2025, mm-hmm. and they're trying to deploy a strategy to build any kind of brand, and they're thinking about the channels, if we think about B2C companies, so things like Good American, or it could be, I don't know, an energy drink or whatever, What kind of strategy are you thinking about now to acquire customers as being some of the most interesting, but maybe unobvious?
Yeah, I really am blown away by what happens when you meet customers in real life, you know, and I think that some of the more experiential things that we've done that stay with people, you know, post-COVID, people want to be together and they want to be in person and they want experience and they want memories and they want things that last and they want physicality and what's tangible. And so whatever you can do that brings those type of experiences, like in real life experience, is always going to beat out anything that is like more digitally native. And so a good example of that is we just opened a store on Sunset for Skims, and we connected the store opening with this incredible diner next door that's like a 24-hour kind of like Hollywood staple diner. There were queues around the block, every single slot for in the entirety of the 6 days, and it's 24 hours, was booked within 5 minutes. And this is to get pancakes and, you know, chicken tenders and like a root beer float. And what was so interesting to me is I took my kids, and it was so cute. You know, it's like a 50s diner with a jukebox, and we Skimsified the whole thing. It looked amazing. My three-year-old, 2 days later, said, I want to go back to the cafe. And I was like, you're English, that's so cool. You want to go to the diner? She's like, yeah, I want to get the thing with the cherry on the top. And I was like, wow, like in a three-year-old's head, that even like she had an impression of like that being like a special moment and something that stuck in her mind. And I was like, those type of things for me are just way more valuable. Now look, if you're starting a business, it's really hard to do experiential in real life things like that. But I think the point is like getting in front of customers, like getting to them and that physicality of being in front of them. And whether that is if you're starting a new drink, like being in the supermarket, being in front of like the point of purchase, like that is really important to tell your story and have some physicality around what you're doing.
Are you seeing this idea of community becoming more and more important for building brands? Because, you know, a couple of years ago, it was all like, just throw some Facebook ads at them or get some influencers to tell them about it. Now we're seeing this transition towards like run clubs and yoga thing with the brand present. And
yeah, I definitely think it's community. And I, you know, when I think about what that means for our businesses. You know, oftentimes it's really about like owning that customer experience. You know, it's like, if you know, for example, Skims has an app, which is like an incredible place for customers to experience the brand. And I think there's like a lot, again, it's like there's high, low ways. There's very, very few brands that can be successful in an app, right? You've got to really have so much brand affinity and so much love to that brand that people will come, get off of whatever they're doing and like click and be in your app. So I think that's certainly not for everybody. I don't think that would work for a lot of the brands that I'm involved in. But the sense of like, standing for something, having some kind of purpose, galvanizing people around something that isn't just about your product is probably the way to go, I think. And you know, Good American has been so successful because it always stood for something. At the end of the day, we were selling blue jeans and white t-shirts, but people understand why they come to that brand. They understand that there's a purpose, but you also have to evolve that purpose continuously. And when I think about where we started 8 years ago and where we are in the middle somewhere, we became B Corp certified. And that was another like, real push for the company. It was very, very, very heavy lifting. But that was something that for our staff became so important to them. You know, denim is a tough business to be in. It's a very pollutive business. I have a lot of really young people, a lot of young mothers that work at the company, and they wanted to know that they worked in a place that cared about the world that they live in. And so it really was something that was an undertaking by that company to say, we all feel that we could do so much better. And I think that the underlying values of that company are about it being about our customers and the people that work there, and whatever is true to them being the most important thing. And so that has really evolved over time.
How old are you here in this photo?
I must be, well, okay, so if Katie is, what she looks like, I must be 16?
16.
15? No, 15.
15, oh yeah.
Yeah. Aww.
If you were to speak to this Emma, and this Emma was keen to start a business, and she came to you and said, what are the like first principles of business? What are the three most important things in being successful in business that you've learned in your decades now of wisdom and experience? What would you say to her?
Oh, bless her. Well, I'd say I love your curly hair, first of all. It's not a bad place to start, actually, because I would say that it's so important to be true to yourself in whatever you do. And, you know, I think that I have an incredible gut instinct and I have very strong feelings that guide the decisions that I make. And that has really led me so well. So I'd be like, have conviction about what it is that you feel deeply and go with that. But by the same token, I'd say, know what you don't know. Because there's a lot of places where I'm weak. And one of my greatest strengths and a superpower of mine has been know what you don't know and hire people into the kind of gaps and the holes that you have in your own knowledge. That's been really important for me. And it's I feel like I'm so privileged that I've worked with people in one company and being able to bring them into another company and another. And I start almost a lot of things with like a similar group of people. And I love that because they fill in for where I'm not so good. And that's been really key. And then despite everything you've been told, you're gonna have to take some risks. And I think that everything that this kid knew was like, don't be risky, don't take any risks, like figure everything out and be really safe. And what I've learned is that nothing is going to come easy. And I think that when I moved here, I moved to America with a two-year-old and a newborn baby. And I had no friends here, not like real friends. And it was a really scary move because you move away from, you know, you forget when you move country, you move from all senses of what is familiar to you. Mm-hmm. And that's very, it's very difficult in any stage of your life, but there's a special vulnerability that comes along with having a new baby and having a new venture that you don't really understand how to run at the time. And so I would say like learning to take risks has probably been the best thing that I've done.
How do you feel about her?
Oh, you know, I think she's so cute and so lovely. You know, I don't like, I feel like that's, you know, I still look exactly the same, don't I?
Yeah, you do.
You know, like, I feel like this person was like dying to just do something differently and dying to escape her circumstances.
Some of the skills that I think you have that are unappreciated, one of them is the ability to articulate an idea. And some people call this like sales. How critical do you think it is for women, for men, for everybody to cultivate that particular skill? And how did you cultivate it?
Oh, I think it's one of the most important things. You know, when I think about who I am investing in, when I think about what businesses to support, I don't care if a founder has a lot of missing pieces, but if you can't sell, you ain't getting my money. Like, no way. Like, it's just no way. No, you can't outsource that stuff. You either have an ability to convince somebody of what you're doing and sell your idea uniquely, or you don't. And I've never invested in any founders that didn't have that as a skill, that couldn't bring me on a journey and tell me their story and convince me that this was something that the world needed.
How do you sell? So if you were selling something to me, what are the core, what would you be thinking about as you're preparing that pitch and putting it together?
Oh, you'll see, you're just so much more thoughtful than I am. I would be so, you know, like my whole thing is like, I have to be passionate about the thing that I'm doing. I have to like see the need. I have to figure out the, like, what am I solving for? And then I go in on that. I'm like, you know, I'm painting the picture of like where the problem sits. And then I'm showing you how I've uniquely come up with the solution. And then I'm, you know, I'm like old school, right? It's like I create a value proposition. I'm all about like the perfect place for pricing. And then it's like, I'm going to get it to you in a unique way. But I don't think it's like so complicated. I'm like a born salesperson. That's just who I am.
When you reference this, you touch your chest a lot.
Oh, do I?
No, but it's interesting
like a
to me.
Heartfelt
That's
thing.
What I'm saying. Yeah. So intuition, feeling.
Having delved into the importance of passion and value propositions in sales, the conversation now shifts to the critical role of hiring exceptional talent. As the discussion unfolds around the strategies for attracting top-tier individuals to a growing company.
It's like the screening process that I talked about, built it myself. It's my absolute obsession because I now have the clarity of hindsight.
Yes.
Where I go, oh my God, my net worth and my outcomes can be correlated to like 10 exceptional people that I brought into my ecosystem 10 years ago and the downstream impact of them hiring more exceptional people, et cetera. But me and you are in a different place now. And if you go back to when you first started your agency all those years ago, mm-hmm. you didn't have the same leverage.
Oh, no way.
So if you're a startup founder now, and they agree with this principle that hiring is so critical, A players really matter, how do they go about, like how would you go about now getting exceptional people to come and join Emma's company?
Yeah. Well, Stephen, that's the reason that you've got to be a great salesperson, otherwise I'm not going to invest in you. But it comes back down to that, right? Because in the beginning, you've got to sell a dream, a vision. You might be willing to give someone some equity, but chances are that equity is worth zilch in the beginning. So you've got to be that person that can say, here's where we're going. We're going to paint a vision. But you've got to have the strategic chops to say, you know, anybody good is going to understand that a founder alone goes nowhere. Right? So it's like, what am I coming into? Like, if it's the founder and it's like very little, then what's the vision that I'm buying into and what's the strategy to get there? So it comes back down to this like idea of like, can you sell a vision? Can you sell the strategy these people are going to come into and actually work towards? And I think that is probably like the thing that I'm good at after. I've had a pretty clear idea about what I'm doing. And I can do that because I don't do very much. Everybody always says to me, how do you do so much? It's like, I don't do very much. What I do is obsessed over the customer. I obsess over a set of products and then I get them to them really quickly. That's it. Like, that's all I do. And so it's not really that much that I do. And I think that it's like so, so, so important for you to be able to do very, very, very few things really, really well.
I think that's it really goes against what a lot of startup founders think they have to be doing because they think they have to be good at everything.
No. I honestly think it's the opposite. And I think that if you start to tell yourself that, it's a slippery slope because no one is good at everything, right? You've got to find people that have expertise, that can do things that you can't do. And that can be really difficult in the beginning. But again, it's like, you have to have, it's like so much of it is about curiosity, asking as many questions as you can so you can start to figure out who is going to be the best person to solve that problem. In the beginning, like, I just feel like I had no idea how so many parts of my business worked. But it's like I would make sure that I would be the person to ask enough questions to get to the point where I could hire somebody that would be competent to do that role, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like you train yourself and you train these muscles that get you better at hiring. And you're going to make some mistakes. Like I never feel like we spend enough time talking about failure, about the mistakes. I've made so many mistakes. I moved a whole bunch of people here to LA and shut the office down 18 months later because I thought I had something that I just didn't have. I thought that the reputation I'd built in London would translate to LA. What I didn't understand is LA is a community and I wasn't part of it. You know, it was like a closed door. I got here and I was like, what? Like, I just frozen out, completely like that.
Yeah.
They're not like us. Like, this is it. So, you know, and it really was. And so I think that, you know, learning, like, not just understanding, okay, I had this thing, it went wrong, but it's like really going deep and being like, where and how did I fail? And how do I consistently get better at that? And staffing is one of those things that you just get better and better and better at it the more you do it.
I'm really obsessed about this idea of like truly exceptional people. And
truly exceptional people.
Yeah, like truly exceptional people. I was listening to something Steve Jobs was saying a couple of weeks ago. I'll throw it up on the screen for anybody.
I've built a lot of my success off finding these truly gifted people and not settling for B and C players, but really going for the A players. And I found something. I found that when you get enough A players together, when you go through the incredible work to find, you know, five of these A players, they really like working with each other because they've never had a chance to do that before. And they don't want to work with B and C players. And so it becomes self-policing. And they only want to hire more A players. And so you build up these pockets of A players and it propagates.
Have you found that to be the case? And also, I want to address another point here, which is the insecurity of an early stage founder who looks up and sees someone that's really experienced. And then they have that sort of self-doubt and go, how the fuck am I going to manage them?
Mm-hmm. You know what? At the risk of disagreeing with anybody so prolific and amazing, I think as someone who has been able to move people between organizations or between companies, sometimes it can be the company that can make people great. You can have a truly exceptional person in a kind of dysfunctional company,
mm-hmm.
and then they don't do as well, right?
Yeah.
Like you can bring in somebody not quite exceptional into an exceptional culture and company, and the organization makes them great.
Makes them look great or makes
them great? No, makes them great. Because what people tend to do is level up, right? Whether you end up the average of the people that you surround yourself most. And I have, in some cases, brought people in, you know, that I'd be like a B minus and they've turned into an A plus. And the more I think about this, Stephen, the more I think that's happened on a number of occasions. And when the organization is exceptional and when the people there are doing exceptional work, they can actually level up the people. Now, there have to be somebody that wants to level up for sure, but I've definitely seen it work that way.
One of the things that I think a lot about, it kind of dovetails into this a little bit because I was referencing how we can sometimes be our own worst enemies and doubt ourselves away from like finding the truly exceptional person. Mm-hmm. So we end up hiring our friends. Is the idea of...
I love this idea that you've hired friends. Who are these friends that you're hiring? Well, did you hire a bunch of friends? Well, it's a terrible bloody idea.
I was 18.
Says me, who works with my husband.
No, I was 18 and I they weren't actually friends, but they weren't qualified. I just met them at like, I met one guy at a Prada store and I was like, you can be my account manager. And then I met some guy at like a rap battle and I was like, you should be my marketing director.
This is great, but between Prada and the rap battle, I get it. I can see all these things weren't happening.
No rigor in deciding who...
No, but that's what it comes down to, like rigor, right? It's like you, again, you've developed systems and processes that have helped you get to where you are. And it's like, now I have a giant organization and a head of people that spend their life, like not just again, bringing people into the organization, but then like making them great once they get there. Like, I had no such thing. I don't think I knew where the HR office was when I was in employment. I mean, like, who are they? Where are they? Some, I don't know, girl called Jo that sits in accounts. Like, I don't know where she was. But I say that because we're in a different time now where there is such an ability for us to be more thoughtful about who we're bringing in. And so I think anyone who's really smart and any founder that's really smart is going to use all the tools. All you need to do is know that it's a really important thing that you will do. Who those first 3, 5, 10 people that you bring into your organization will be the difference between good and great. And so being slow and thoughtful and purposeful and using everything at your disposal to make those decisions is probably the best time that a founder can spend outside of developing products or whatever the end product is.
How do you think about prejudice, Emma? I mean, what I really mean here is being counted out before you walk in the room. So people hear that it might be a woman or something else, and you feel that mm-hmm. they're not taking you seriously. Has that happened in your career as a black person, as a woman, as anything that puts you in the minority as it relates to the accomplishments you've made? Do you know what? I'm going to give you a bit more context as to why I asked
this. Yeah, go
this.
On, frame.
It's because one of my fears
yeah.
is with some people, they count themselves out before they walk in the room because prejudice is real, so they limit themselves. And there's a really great study they did many, many years ago where they got a group of black people, I believe it was on a vocabulary test, just to talk about their race before they did the vocabulary test. And if they got them to talk about their race before, their performance dropped. If they didn't get the group to talk about their race before in a different study, performance was the same. Mm-hmm. They did the same with women. They got them to identify their gender before doing a maths test. And because there's a stereotype around maths, or at least there was at the time in women, women on that test would perform worse if they talked about their gender right before they did the test. Mm-hmm. But importantly, if they didn't, the results were the same as everybody else. So stereotype threat is a real thing. And the unpopular conversation is there could be ways that we're holding ourselves back before we even walk into the room because of that stereotype threat. Mm-hmm. It could be age, it could be race, it could be gender, it could be anything else. It could be a disability. And I just wonder how you think about, like, you know, that.
I mean, look, it's undoubtable that that is real for so many people in their lives and the way they think about themselves. I think that any thoughtful organization has, and certainly in more recent times, if we think about what's happened in the last 5 years, anybody that didn't look at their company hiring process and beyond the hiring process.
Having delved into the profound impact of stereotype threat on individuals, the conversation now shifts to a deeply personal journey as one shares the emotional challenges faced during the pursuit of motherhood through IVF and the heartache that followed.
I'd be like, a baby. You know, like I just was single track, like all I could think about was, I need to be pregnant.
Why soul destroying?
You know, it was soul destroying because I went through multiple rounds of IVF, and every single time, for me, actually, it did work out. But then I lost a baby 3 times. And it was just awful, you know. And for me, it happened at 9 weeks, 11 weeks and 16 weeks. And so, you know, at that point, 16 weeks, you're about to tell people. You are, you know, you think you're past the sort of danger zone, so to speak. Something in my heart told me that it wasn't going to work out for me. Like, I actually think I knew deep down, but you're doing all the things, you know, I'm having the acupuncture and the doctors all feel great about it. And of course, you know, you have IVF and then it's successful. You're like, great, now I'm pregnant, I'm having a baby. And so that loss was just, it was so hard to deal with. And again, you know, it was a very isolating time because it was like COVID. I was on my, like, driving in a, you know, in gloves and a hazmat suit. You know, it was like the time when we really didn't know. And, you know, and the roads were empty and it was tough. You know, the police would pull you over and I'd be like, I'm going to the IVF clinic, which was like one of the few things that you were allowed to be on the road and driving around for. So it was just very, very difficult. But, you know, I had a happy ending. And so for me, my journey ended in something that I never thought would be a way that I would go. But I ended up deciding that I would have a surrogate. And I met an incredible woman and she carried my twins, which was the like single biggest thing that anyone can ever do. You're like, what? Like, this is so crazy. And it was amazing. I had like such a profound, incredible pregnancy with this amazing, wonderful woman who, beyond what our contractual commitment was, you know, because you hear horror stories, like she asked me for nothing. It was a beautiful, amazing partnership. And my twins were born via surrogacy. And that was that.
Complicated emotions.
No. And, you know, I have to tell you, Stephen, I'd love to, like, maybe I approached it more like a bit of a, like, I was very transactional about it.
Not the surrogacy.
No.
In the moment before.
Oh, beyond complicated emotions, because you are, you know, I've had pregnancy loss before I decided to have children. You know, I've had a complicated, as so many women have, a complicated fertility journey. It was emotions that were, I would say, too hard to bear. And for somebody who's used to being able to get her way and work towards things being as they should be, and to me, it's like the amount of effort I put in directly correlates to the result, and there was no such thing in this. You could have all the shots and all the acupuncture and do everything that you're supposed to do, not work out too much, don't go in a sauna, you know, like be an angel, eat all of the right things, and still I couldn't, you know, hold on to the pregnancy. So to me, it was just something that I couldn't bear.
In that moment, are there any, are there decisions that you wish you'd made? Or is there something you'd wish you'd known? Because we don't talk about this enough, so people end up going through this themselves.
You know what? I'll tell you, I wish I'd have spoken about it more with all of my friends that had gone through it. And I will tell you this story. I was a couple of summers ago, you know, I'm often the person people confide in. And I happened to be, I won't say where, I was in this place, very confined, like on a boat. And all of the women were in some type of fertility thing. Like they had different things going on. And I looked around and I knew I was the only one of all five of us that knew everybody's thing. And I was like, we could be having such a good conversation now, right? Like it would be so rich and so useful because again, like there was somebody that had like had kids by IVF. There was someone who had just come from somewhere. There was somebody that was in the middle of like diagnosing endometriosis. And there was somebody who was pregnant, but not telling everyone she was pregnant because it was IVF and she'd had the problem. But anyway, like everybody had their own unique circumstances. And I was like, in a group of women where we discuss, I won't even say what we discuss, but we discuss every single thing, that is like the last taboo. It says something about your womanhood that it would be such a deeply held secret and something that you just can't discuss is such a shame. And I'm not saying that that's what it is for all women and all groups of friends, but it's definitely something that people really, really struggle with talking about. And certainly for me, going down the surrogacy route, I really felt an element of, I wouldn't say shame, but it was like, oh, why could I was willing to do this myself. Like, why couldn't I? Like, I should have just been able to do it. I was ready, you know, at 38 to like have to like go back on the workouts and, you know, like, you know, figure myself out again. And so I felt like I'd been robbed of an opportunity to do something. And then, you know, coming out of it, I was like, wow, that was such a profound experience that I would never have had all of these things not happen. And so in a weird way, I was just kind of grateful for the opportunity to have been, you know, to have been able to see how selfless like another human being could be.
Were you aware of the biological clock in the way that people are now aware of it back then?
Yeah, I was, although I have to tell you that there's nothing, you know, for most women, we spend all of our time thinking about how to not get pregnant. Yeah. It's just like, you know, I just want to like not get pregnant forever until it's your moment that you want to get pregnant. And then there's this second moment where it's like, it's no longer your choice. And the window's really, really narrow. And so I, you know, again, I have hundreds of women in my office. And I mentioned to you at the start of this conversation, you know, there was some fertility seminar yesterday. I think that there's still so many myths around it. You know, there is no good time. You can freeze eggs, but it's not like freezing embryos. It's very different, right? Mm-hmm. And so the idea that the decision is all ours is just not realistic, and that there is a window, and it is narrow, and it is something that you have to think about. And I think that there are a lot of women that know that they don't want children. That's fine. But if you do, it's really something that you ought to be more planful of, because it's bloody difficult and it's not how you think.
Thank you. Thank you for talking about that, because there, as you say, there's not enough people that talk about it. And actually, had I not had the access to information on doing this podcast and meeting these women who have been very open about it, I would have had no idea. And I would have probably found myself in a bit of a struggle, because me and my partner weren't thinking about that.
No,
we're thinking about getting the bag. We're thinking about building our businesses.
Of course you are.
And we're 32 now.
Yeah.
So when I hear people like you say, listen, if this is something you want, then plan.
Totally.
Make a plan. And I don't think many people listening actually have a plan for children. They see it as the thing they'll get round to when they're ready. But this clock, man, it's like,
The clock is ticking.
Don't work like that. I've got an idea. I think you should start a podcast.
Stephen, whatever you say, I will do. It's a great idea. Let's go. What should it be called?
I think you should call it Aspire.
That is great.
And I think you should launch it in May.
Stephen, you're so incredibly smart and thoughtful.
Oh, thank you, Emma.
And I feel like if my podcast could be born here and be just half the podcast that you have,
I think you can level up. You know, this is what you said. You said people come and see something, then they level up.
So they level up.
Why podcasting? So your podcast launches in May. It's called Aspire.
Yeah.
What are you trying to achieve? What's the mission there?
Yeah, you know, I'm so glad that you asked a question like that, because for me, it is a little bit of a mission. And I think that the more success I've had, and I'm sure this is very similar to you, and you've mentioned it on a few occasions. And actually, I remember being out with you in Manchester. Do you remember when we had to like walk like from the studio to the bar where we were doing that thing? And you know, it's like inundated with people and questions, and people just wanted like just get like this one thing that they're trying to figure out across the line and say like, Stephen, like how do I do this? And so that happens to me all the time wherever I go, and I've made it a habit of mine in the morning on the way to the work to just like jump on the phone to someone for half an hour. I do it almost every day, 4 days out of five. And I'll speak to some founder and give them like 30 minutes of whatever it is that I can. And so the podcast was honestly from the beginning about figuring out like, how can I scale mentorship? How can you get to this place where all of these people that want to ask me questions can actually get some answers from me? And you know, the podcasting was not the first thing that came to my head, but the more I looked into it, because I am a huge podcast listener, I listen to so many podcasts, but it's kind of interesting that for such a kind of broad space, there is kind of such a narrow point of view in so many ways. Mm. It's so many men hosting podcasts. And when we start to think about business, it becomes even more male dominated. And so in my head, I was like, well, I just have a very different point of view. I have very different experience. I have a very different, you know, access. And what's been so interesting is all the people I called up to do a podcast, they'd never done a podcast before.
Really?
Yeah. Everyone that I was like, hey, would you come on? They were like, I've never done this. And I was like, well, that's interesting. And immediately, even just from that kind of casting point of view, I was like, oh, maybe I have a distinct point of view that could be interesting here. But all I want to do is very, very simply is take what I've learned and take the people that I know and have it be impactful, because I feel like everyone aspires to something. Everybody wants to build the life of their dreams. And so I was really thinking about this as something that maybe if I could facilitate conversations and tell people more about the journey that I've been on and be really thoughtful about what it takes, right? Because I just feel like, again, in like the female like media landscape, there's so much toxic positivity. And I'm like, babe, you're not going to be able to manifest your way there. Like, I'll tell you the truth if you want to listen. And if you're willing to put the work in, like all of these things could be, you know, applicable and, you know, you could have access. And so that's what I want to do. I want to just like do things how I do them, be honest with people, bring in people that I know and be honest about my journey. And I'm excited to do it. Like I've done a couple of episodes and I'm like, I'm just having a chat.
I think of all the things you've done in your life, I think the more and more that you've find yourself in the public eye, and the more of the work that you do on your podcast, Aspire. I think that is ultimately going to be the greatest part of your legacy. And I say that because there is nobody else able and capable of occupying that space that I can see. There is no one who comes from where you come from, who has been on the journey that you've been on, both in the UK and in the US, that's climbed both mountains, that is relatable, even though that they're so high up the mountain, that is had to contend with some of the things you've contended with, which many women and men contend with, which is like parenthood and family, that is articulate, that is seasoned across a variety of different environments and spaces, that is also a Black woman. There is nobody. And if you reflect on you as that young girl looking up at Oprah, or me like looking up at Jamal Edwards, it was so important.
Yeah.
It was the kernel of belief that stays in your mind that says, if they can, there's no reason I can't. Mm-hmm. And I've said this to my team before a ton of times over the last couple of months about you. I'm like, there's no other Emma. So she almost has a responsibility to that gap. Because you've done incredible things in your life. You've done so much philanthropic work, which I'll put all in the description below to help so many people. But it's not lost on me that, like, the older I've gotten, just seeing someone that you can, that makes you realize that, that brings down those like limiting beliefs that you have or that society has passed to you, could go on to create 100,000 Emmas. And that it's hard to think of a more like astonishing, important legacy than that, like the 10 million Emmas that you will create. And so I'm so glad you're doing this, because I've said to my team a ton of times, like, there's not another Emma. There's not someone else that could occupy that position. So it's so important that you're successful in it. And it's so important that you continue to do it.
That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram and visit our website, podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.